Yeah. So I'd like to continue to talk about So I'm going to talk today about peripheralization of zeros and prime numbers. I have lecture notes that they distributed and ran out of. So, and I actually made these transparency. I made the lecture notes, and then I copied them and cut out all the sentences to make these lecture notes. So all the formulas here are already in the lecture notes. You don't have to try to scribble them down. So my only job is to try to remember all the words that I cut out now. So anyhow, the first part's pretty much Roger already did it all, but I'll just review it again. So in this subject, we always let S be sigma plus IT, a notation due to Riemann. That's our complex variable. And the zeta function is given by its Dirichlet series, which is equal to this Euler product for sigma bigger than 1. And p will always be a prime number. Whenever you see it, that means a product over primes or a sum over primes. And maybe I can move around a little here. So you can't really... It's hard to extract information from a product, usually. So we take the logarithmic derivative so that we can get the primes in a sum. So usually when we look at zeta prime over zeta, we just use a single s there. We don't put it on the top and the bottom. That's sort of standard notation. And that's the derivative of the log of zeta. And then when you take the log of that product, you'll get the sum of the logs of each term, and there's the minus 1 power. And then you expand minus log into its power series. And I'm unhappy to say I'm about the only person who's published a paper where I expanded exactly this log wrong and lost the minus sign. But it was my fault. Anyhow, and then if you look at this, and then you differentiate with respect to S the sum, and then you get back the minus sign and you get a log on top. So if you look at this sum here, if n is p to the m, then you have a sum over integers that are of the form p to the m, prime to a power, and the coefficient is log of p. So consequently, you get the Dirichlet series with the von Mongold function in it. So because of this formula, it makes a lot more sense to use lambda of n as your sort of indicator function for primes. So I know people at first are a little bit annoyed because it counts primes with a weight and it includes prime powers, but both of those can be easily fixed whenever you want to. And then we have the counting function for lambda, which is psi of x. And we normally just think of this as just counting the prime. I mean, I always think of this as just counting the primes up to x. It's just the primes are weighted by 1 over their density, so you end up getting x there. So the first point is that we prefer lambda to psi, I mean lambda to the indicator function for primes, and we prefer psi to pi, the number of primes up to x, except when you want to make a statement specifically about primes. And then the prime number theorem says that psi is asymptotic to x, and pi of x, the number of primes up to x, is just x over log x. And then usually we use the prime number theorem in the form that Roger's going to finish proving soon, I think, which is the form of that De Laval-Poisson proved in 1899, which says that really psi of x plus an error, this e to the minus c square root of log. And when you convert back to pi, you find that the main term isn't x over log of x, it's the logarithmic integral, which is preferable in every way to x over log of x.
So
the logarithmic integral is the integral from up to x of 1 over log of u du. And a lot of times you're going to use these formulas with partial summation to work out sums over primes. And so you're going to have to differentiate. And if you think about it, which would you rather differentiate, x over log of x or the integral up to x of 1 over log? I mean, it's sort of obvious, except to my students, of course. I left off the x in the error terms. Yeah, this would have been an amazing... Yeah, there's an x in here. Thanks. So this is just smaller than the main term by that factor. Now, if you want to know the, if you want to know the best, best error, by the way, it only improves that square root of log to like a. Oh, there's my trim. This is, okay. Let's see here. Okay. The best error term just improves that square root of log to like log of x to the 3/2 power. So. Or a little with an extra little factor. So the best we know today, you know, isn't, I mean, it's a little bit better than that error term, but for most applications it doesn't make any difference. So we still, most people still use this original form of the error term when they're working with primes. And there's an even simpler form where this exponential square root of log is always smaller than any power, 1 over any power of log. And it's pretty traditional to just, when you use the prime number theorem, just to automatically use this error estimate, you know, freely whenever you need to. And this double less than sign, I know it has often a different meaning in physics, although I don't know any physics, but it really means here big O of. It always means this thing is equal to big O of that side. Now, the... we also like to work with the with 1 over zeta a lot in this kind of work. And I just sort of wanted to introduce the Mobius function. So 1 over zeta, if you look at the Euler product and just multiply it out, gives you a Dirichlet series that has a coefficient of mu of n, the Mobius function. Maybe I can show you that for a second here. So if you just think of this Euler product, when you take 1 over zeta, you lose that minus 1. And just think of multiplying out that product, and you'll have like 1 minus 1 over 2 to the s, 1 minus 1 over 3 to the s. You're just going to get terms that have individual prime factors, so there won't be any squared factors. So the resulting sum will be over square free numbers, and the coefficient is just 1 with the same number of minuses as the number of primes. So that gives you the Mobius function as the coefficient of that Dirichlet series. Anyhow, the zeta function, just to remind you, it has a simple pole with residue 1 at s equals 1. It has trivial zeros at the negative even integers. It has non-trivial or complex zeros, which we always denote by rho equals beta plus I gamma. And beta is always between 0 and 1. Just leave things there. The beta less than 1 is the key ingredient in proving the prime number theorem by analytic methods. And then the zeros are symmetrically positioned around the half line and the real line. So whenever you have a zero row, you'll also have the corresponding complex conjugate zero below, and you'll have 1 minus row by the functional equation and conjugate of it. So they come in groups of 4 if they're off the half line. And then the Riemann hypothesis is that the real part of every zero is a half, So you can write each zero as a half plus I gamma. Now when we count the zeros, you can just let, I made up a new name here. Little n of t is the zeros between 0 and less than or equal to t. But we usually count them with this n of t, which is, like Roger said, I think, you can't actually take t to be right on, right at the height where a 0 hits, because you'd be running through a 0. And the convention is to, if there is a 0 on this line at height t, to take it with weight a half. So you normally would take a line above t, a line below t, and take a sequence of them approaching t. So that's, n of t is usually defined right on the line if there is a 0 to take those zeros with weight a half. And then the Riemann-von-Mongold formula is obtained by applying the argument principle and using the functional equation, which generates the main terms. So the number of zeros up to height t is this t over 2 pi log of t over 2 pi. The e is a convenient way to sort of get that second term right. There's a 7/8. There's this continuous function r of t which goes to 0 like 1 over t, that I think comes out of the Stirling expansion. And it's, the main thing about it is that it's completely known. It's a continuous function. It can actually be expanded into a series of terms. So it's pretty much not a problem. And then there's s of t, which is the 1 over pi, the change in the argument of zeta, as you till you get to the point 1/2 plus it. And as we saw, s of t is bounded by log of t, and that's an estimate, I think, from like 1895 or something like that. And it's never been improved. So really the whole study of entity, if you want, reduces down to s of t, because s of t will have the same jumps at the zeros that n of t does. And it has a little bit of its own behavior, too. Actually, this s of t estimate that it's bounded by log of t, that was the first talk I ever gave as a graduate student was in a seminar, was to prove this. And right after the seminar, I thought, well, why don't I improve this estimate, and then I can get a PhD thesis on it. And so I worked away and never failed to ever do anything like everyone else. And I actually think you can prove that if you assume the Lindelof hypothesis, which is a fairly hard hypothesis, which says that the zero, one formulation of the Lindelof hypothesis, the zeta function is bounded by t to the epsilon on the half line. And it's implied by the Riemann hypothesis, but the Lindelof hypothesis implies that s of t is little o of log of t. And I actually believe that the converse is true, too, and you can prove it. That, in fact, if you could improve the bound here to little o of log of t, that would imply the Lindelof hypothesis. And it really looks like you could do that, but I haven't succeeded yet. I've given up on it. But I actually think it's true. And so if you're trying to improve on this S of T estimate, you probably have to prove the Lindelof hypothesis. The main point of this formula, when you're not really doing detailed study on zeros, is just that there are t over 2 pi log t zeros in the critical strip. And oftentimes people who prove the Riemann hypothesis fail to realize this and actually prove there's no zeros in the critical strip. And the standard estimate we actually use here is that in an interval of length 1, so if you look at n of t plus 1 minus n of t, and you difference, you will get a log of t term from the main term, and s of t is bounded by log of t. So the number of zeros in interval length 1 in the vertical direction is log of t. It's bounded by log of t. And this is actually a sharp estimate. You're not going to be able to improve it. So this is not an abstract subject when you get down to it. Here are the first five zeros. And I computed them by going to Odlisko's website and copying them, but deleting, I think he had the first 1,000 digits of each. So I had to cut them out. And anyhow, so you can see the first zero is actually at a half plus I 14. It doesn't start getting a zero for a while. And some people wonder why that is, why it is. Do you know, Brian, why it starts at 14? I mean, why isn't there a zero at like 1 or 2 when they're getting close? I'm gonna give another reason, but I don't know if it's true. I just came up with it last night. But I mean, the question is why is it so large?
Yeah. From the first term of the Riemann-Siegel formula, which is quite accurate, I think.
I see. So it's actually out of the Riemann-Siegel formula.
Well, for example.
Uh huh. Okay. I'm still going to give another reason, but but I'm not actually sure it's right. Anyhow, so let me leave these zeros here for a second, for a few. Let me keep them sort of on the side there. So now we're going to talk about explicit formulas. And I think this is Roger's next lecture, the lecture after. Yeah, so now you can just refer to me. If you really want to do anything on this subject of zeros and primes and their connection, you really have to be able to work with explicit formulas. And this is the kind of sentence I wouldn't normally say. It sounds like I'm preaching. But actually, I remember a talk Montgomery gave way back in 1978, and he actually said this. And he was right, I think. You really have to be able to work with explicit formulas. And here's the first explicit. This is the best-known explicit formula, which is usually called the explicit formula. And it says that psi of x, you know, the number of primes up to x, with this convention that if you actually have a prime equal to x, you take it with weight a half, sort of usual thing, is x, that's the prime number theorem, minus a sum of x to the rho over all the complex zeros, and this factor, which is the value of zeta prime over zeta at zero, and this is actually the trivial zeros, the series of trivial zeros to this form when you sum it up. So anyhow, this is an exact formula, and if you just like formulas, this is the answer to primes, and there's nothing else to do but just stare at it, really, because it basically tells you everything. It tells you exactly the number of primes up to x, assuming you know all the zeta zeros exactly. And really what it tells you is there's the main term, the prime number theorem, and here are lower order terms. Each zero gives you a lower order term. Now, this sum doesn't converge absolutely, because remember the zeros are spaced closer than integers, and if rho was just an integer, this would be a harmonic series when you absolute value it. And the convention is that you have to, when you actually add it up, you have to group each zero with its corresponding complex conjugate below. And then that's the sense in which it converges. And you can actually, from the explicit formula, see that the series isn't absolutely convergent, because if you take x approaching 1, this is the formula for x, is valid for any x greater than 1, then you can see that the number of zeros less than 1 is less, any number less than 2 is 0. So this term's 0, this term's 1, and this term approaches whatever it does as x goes to 1. This is nothing, and this term blows up. So you can see that as x approaches 1, the sum over zeros is going to blow up. And explicitly, if you let x be e to the u, you get this formula as U approaches zero, or the sum over zero, so it approaches this one, it sort of blows up logarithmically. And this is actually a useful fact. Now, you can obtain it by the Riemann von Mangold counting function too, but you can get it directly out of the explicit formula. So, let me keep these. Now, usually for applications, it's handy to not have your series over zeros go all the way up to infinity. So you usually use a truncated version of the explicit formula, which is how you prove the complete one anyway. When you rigorously prove it, you basically do it up to a height t and then let t go to infinity and make sure that everything converges. So here's the explicit formula truncated for zeros less than height in absolute value t. And there's an error term, x over t, log squared. And there's an error term here that takes into account the jumps. Psi will have jumps of log at each prime or prime power. So you have this error term that's pretty small but has to take into account the jumps. You can see, in fact, this minimum business, you know, will basically take into account as you approach the jump. But in any case, this is just a psi log of x. And let me give you an application to the prime number theorem, sort of a standard one, which is, if you assume the Riemann hypothesis, then the zeros have real part of half, and the absolute value of x to the half plus I gamma will, in fact, be x to the half, because the x to the imaginary power in absolute value is 1. And, of course, the bottom is the half plus I gamma, when gamma is large, essentially gamma, but you're bounded by removing the real part. So this is the estimate for each term in this sum. So when you insert this into here, you'll get an x to the half in front of the sum. You just have to sum 1 over the reciprocal of the imaginary parts. And since it's symmetric, I could just add up the zeros from 1 to t and multiply by 2 for the ones below the real line. And I can start at 1 because the first zero is at 14. And then I can break up this sum into pieces of length 1 from n to n plus 1, and then add them up to the next integer larger than t. And each one of these intervals, 1 over gamma, is bigger than 1 over n. And this is interval length 1, so there's log of n of these of zeros in this interval. And then you just integrate this function to compare it with the sum, and you get log squared of t. So this is a pretty crude estimate, but it gives you what's still the best error term that's known in the prime number theorem, assuming the Riemann hypothesis. So if you now insert over here this log squared of t times x to the half into here, and you take x t to be x, so those other error terms are just of size log, you get this form of the prime number theorem due to von Koch in 1901, which has never been improved. So we really haven't been able, if you think of that argument, we just haven't been able to get any cancellation out of the complex part of the zeros. The imaginary part. And no one's ever been able to, really. Now, you can prove each one of those terms is about size x to the half. And if there was a zero off the half line, you would actually not be able to have the other terms cancel it off by pretty elementary reasoning. So if the Riemann hypothesis, if this error term was bigger than x to the half plus epsilon, you would have to have a zero off the half line. And conversely, so often you would say this statement's equivalent to the Riemann hypothesis, or the statement with x to the half plus epsilon is. So it's an equivalence with the Riemann hypothesis that doesn't actually help you do either of the two facts, but shows you the relation. Now here's another application which is commonly done, which is let's look at the gap between large prime. So let's look at the gap between consecutive primes from this formula. So you let Pn denote the nth prime. And what I'm first going to do here is I'm going to remove the prime powers from the psi of x. So when you look at psi of x, it's the primes up to x, and then it's all the prime powers. So I remove the first power, and the question is how many prime powers are there? And the highest prime power you can have is the power you have to raise 2 to, since that's the smallest prime. So since 2 to the k, you need 2 to the k to be less than or equal to x, then the highest power of any prime you'll find less than x is the log base, the integer part of the log base 2 of x. So here I've stopped the prime powers at the largest one you can possibly have in this interval. And so I put out the primes. I'll pull out the prime squared here. And then the remaining ones, I'll replace the sum by the most you could have, which is the cube, the primes cubed. So you get pi of x to the third, and there's at most log of these terms, and there's another log from the log of p. So consequently, psi is really equal to the sum of the primes up to x of log of p. And then by the prime number theorem, the prime squared give you a factor of x to the half. I mean, there's x to the half over log x primes, but there's a log of x from the log of p. Yeah. Now, this is perfectly acceptable. You see, this x to the half is acceptable because it's smaller than the error term up here. Basically, this estimate works. But what's sort of ironic about this argument is that historically, these prime squared actually ruined the argument for oscillations, the traditional oscillation results, when you tried to go from psi to pi of x. And that's why there's a theorem called Littlewood's theorem that had to overcome this problem that the prime squared actually contributed enough to show to this amount is enough to neutralize the previously known omega results for the size of the error had to be here. Anyhow, to finish up here then, you now see from here that I'll just up here, I'll difference this equation between, I'll take x in this equation, I'll take x plus h in this equation, and I'll difference. And I'll do it just for primes. So what I'll get is the number of primes between x and x plus h weighted by log of p is h. But when you difference that error term up there, you can't tell that it's going to cancel at all. And even when you keep it in the form of the explicit formula, you really can't tell much either. So you just have to take that error term here. So you can now see if I really want to have primes in this interval between x and x plus h, I need h to be bigger than the error term. So if you take h to be a constant times the size of the error term and make this constant bigger than the implicit constant in the error term, then you know that this sum is positive and bigger than h. So consequently, with this choice for h, this interval from x to x plus h has to have h over log x primes, and therefore it has to have two primes if h is big enough. So therefore, if you now take Pn to be the first prime bigger than x, then the next prime, which is Pn plus 1, is still going to be in this interval. So the difference between the two is less than the length of the interval, which is this c x to the half log squared. X is smaller than Pn, so we traditionally just reinsert Pn for x here. And this is the bound we have for for the gap between primes. And it's actually a pretty weak bound, but it's pretty much the best we can do with on the Riemann hypothesis. Almost the best we can do. Okay, well, let me now. So those were a few examples of how you do pretty basic estimates from the explicit formula on primes. And I wanted to show you a few more explicit formulas. This is If you look at this explicit formula, it's sort of like the derivative of the previous one. And this one's a fairly well-known one called, it's usually called Landau's formula. And it says if you just add up x to the rho over the zeros, what you actually get is a main term plus a small error, but that you only have the main term if x is a prime or a prime power. Otherwise, there's nothing. So this lambda of x is really the lambda of x we had before, the lambda we had before, but we just say that if x isn't a prime or prime power, it's zero. It's defined for any real x. So this is really what Roger meant, I think, or he can correct me, by saying that you can convert any statement about primes into a statement about zeros, because if I have a statement about primes, it's a statement about lambda. And all I have to do here is divide the 2 pi over t with a minus to this side, and if I want to formulate something about twin primes, I would replace this lambda by this formula over zeros, and I would take another lambda at n plus k and plug it into here, and then I would multiply the two together. Is this what you meant? Or no. Yeah. You get a statement that totally has zeros and no primes, which is totally useless, but you do have it. Anyhow, so this formula actually, it turns out, what I didn't tell you, it's not actually uniform in x and t, and to really use it, right here it's for fixed x. You have to actually look at the error terms. There's some x dependence in this error term. You have to actually look at that. And two people at this conference, Gonick and Fujii, have both come up with uniform versions of this formula that you can actually use in practice if you want to. This is right. This is where I wanted to get back to. This is the idea I had last night. A long time ago, I had to give a talk to these. We used to give talks to high school students at night. Now, we do it now, but we do it in a good way, where the students who come really want to come. But a long time ago, they used to come only because they got credit from their teacher towards their grade. So I had to give a talk on zeros of the zeta function. And afterwards, a student came up and she said, "Can I have your autograph?" And you know, I was sort of, whoa. She must have really loved it. And then the next student came up and wanted my autograph, and everyone wanted my autograph because that's how they got the credit from their teacher, was by showing the signature of the speaker. And of course, during the whole talk, they had just sort of slept. And you know. Anyhow, so what I had done for them, you know, was I had taken this formula and I'd put the first 10 zeros of the zeta function into about two or three digits. And I had showed them how you just took the first 10 zeros in here and took the absolute value and graphed it with Mathematica, you could actually see that 6 was not a prime or a prime power. And you could actually, if you graphed it up to about 20 with just about, I think I only had about 10 of the zeros, you could distinctly see, you know, you could sort of see the spikes coming up at the prime powers, and you could definitely tell that numbers like 14 were definitely not a prime power. And what happened, though, is I actually typed in some of the zeros wrong, and it was still working. And so I tried it out, and it turns out, you know, if you just wanted to tell whether the first like 20 numbers, whether they're a prime power or not, it's actually not very sensitive. I mean, you don't have to actually use any precision, because I actually just truncated all the zeros at their integer part. So the first zero was 14, and the next one was 21, and the formula still worked pretty good until, you know, for quite a while. But what I was thinking last night is that if you think about it, at the beginning, this formula has to spike all the time. If you think about prime powers less than 10, there's only one of them, you see, at 6. Every other number, this formula has to detect. And maybe it's the case, maybe this is stupid, but maybe it's the case that if the first zero wasn't up at about 14, it would just be impossible by this formula to tell that 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 and 7 and 8 and 9 are primes and prime powers. There's just so many of them, and it's so busy hitting those guys that it couldn't do it if it had a smaller... Well, okay, so that's my idea. I'm taking it. Erasing it. Well... Now, we have a lot of explicit formulas, and this is one due to Cromere, and they get worse. And this one has a sum over zeros and sums over primes. So that's Cromere's formula. And Cromere actually worked hard with that formula and wrote a series of papers. And you can sort of simplify it down asymptotically to a sum over zeros is basically a sum over primes, pretty close to a certain variable. And work with this formula and improve that previous estimate on gaps between primes by one logarithm. So basically, by using this formula instead of that trivial argument, you can save one logarithm on the gap between consecutive primes, assuming RH. And this is not this is not much improvement, but this is still the best result that's known today for what's known. So in fact, when you actually come to look at individual gaps between primes, our analysis is really lousy. But what underlies this are some estimates that are not nearly as bad. So you can sort of... In this one case, you just really do a bad job. Now, Cromere also had his model for primes, and he conjectured, in fact, that the gap between consecutive primes is always the limb soup when divided by log squared of the prime is 1. And, there has been actually some suggestions that that's wrong, but the idea was to replace 1 by, 2e to the minus gamma, maybe. So basically, everyone still believes that the gaps are bounded by some constant times log squared. So if you look at this number and you look at this size, you can see that these things are just way, way too large. Now, when you work with explicit formulas a lot, you find that you can pretty much invent your own explicit formula as needed by just integrating the logarithmic derivative against a kernel. And some of these cases, the kernel, usually you introduce a new variable to help you move your explicit formula around. And a lot of times you simply add a variable z on into the kernel. Sometimes you multiply it, like in the Cromere one. And you just... In all cases, you basically just integrate this with its Dirichlet series and come up with a sum over primes with a kernel weight. This is when the C is bigger than 1, and you can use the Dirichlet series. And then you just move the whole contour over and pick up the residues from all the poles of zeta prime over zeta, which are the zeros, any poles of the kernel you've introduced, and so on, and come up with the explicit formula. Now, there's a lot of details in actually doing that, but they're pretty standard. And one general formula is called a Vey explicit formula, where you actually keep sort of general weights here, and then you try to basically use the weights in general and just try to look at the form of the equation. So that's one approach, is to always start with a general explicit formula and specialize as you need it. But some of us just don't like to do that. Some of us would prefer to start with a specific explicit formula and then work with it. And pretty much, if you start with a specific one and if you're clever enough, you can turn it into any other thing you want. So this is the explicit formula I'm going to be using. It's due to Montgomery. And in this case, we assume the Riemann hypothesis, really not for the right-hand side, but just to simplify the sum over zeros. And if we... we'll look at this formula in a minute. Let me just mention how you prove it. Maybe since I have the notes out there. I won't try to force you here to try to check every detail, but the proof's pretty interesting because you don't actually have to do anything except for quote this formula from Landau's 1909 handbook and then add it at two values. And if you look at this formula, it's really the original explicit formula we had before if you take s equals 0. So if you, in here you take s equals 0, then this is the sum of lambda, so that's the psi. This is actually the log of 2 pi, because that's zeta prime over zeta 0. And there's x to the 1 over 1. And here's the same sum over zeros. And this is the trivial zero sum. So basically, it's a straight generalization of the explicit formula with a new variable. And the proof is essentially identical. If you actually go back to Landau's handbook, he actually derived this one because he wanted to be able to integrate it and prove Riemann's original explicit formula for pi of x, which is a more complicated explicit formula, but historically interesting. Anyhow, if you start with this formula, and we're going to come back and look at it again, because it's interesting because it's really telling you that the logarithmic derivative can be first given as a partial sum of its Dirichlet series, so you can basically truncate it, and then the error in truncating it is a sum over zero. So you're able to study the logarithmic derivative of the zeta function as a prime piece plus a zero piece, which is useful when you go on. Anyhow, Montgomery really just wanted to study zeros, so he sort of first obtained the zero sum in terms of all the other stuff. And then I think he had a pretty good idea here, which is that he first took S to be way over in the region where the Dirichlet series converges at 3 halves plus IT. So when you plug that into this sum, here's the sum over zeros after you assume the Riemann hypothesis. But here, the Dirichlet series for zeta prime over zeta cancels out its first x terms here, and you just get a Dirichlet series tail for n bigger than x. And then you do the same thing. But now you put it at the symmetric point 1 minus s, except for you keep the imaginary part at it instead of minus it. So now you bring it all the way over outside the critical strip on the other side. And then at that point, zeta prime over zeta really is essentially constant. It's essentially minus log by the functional equation. And so then you now have the original part of the Dirichlet series, and you have stuff that's well known. And when you add the two, the inside combines perfectly to give that formula over there. So so it's just sort of it's just combining things in a clever way. So now if you look at Montgomery's formula for a minute before we actually use it, see, if you think about it, the sum over zeros is, you have this parameter t now, and really if gamma isn't close to t, then this the bottom is large and it's going to fall off. So if you think about it, that sum over zeros essentially, when you work with it, is just like the zeros between, it's essentially weighted so that it's just the zeros between t and t plus 1 x to the I gamma. So that's the sum over zeros is basically oscillation in an interval of length bounded or 1. On the other hand, if you look at the sum over primes, the Dirichlet series there, this weight is basically centered when n is x. And then it sort of falls off on either side of x. So basically, the weight here is essentially 1 when n is around x, and then it falls off. So basically, the Dirichlet series is sort of essentially just lambda over n to the it, and for n between x over 2 and 2x, essentially. And finally, the other significant term here is this term here is what you get if you just put the prime number theorem into this Dirichlet series and integrate it and try to replace this by the continuous part, and you come up with this factor. So this is basically the prime number theorem main term for this, or the expected value, sort of. I forgot one more. This term here, you see, when x approaches 1, there's no oscillation here. And this is actually essentially the sum that Roger was looking at yesterday. And it's just reflected by this term here. When x approaches 1, you just get log of t, which is what this approaches when there's no cancellation. And that final term is a junk term. It's just junk. Okay, so now here's what Montgomery did with this formula. He wanted to look at differences between consecutive zeros, so it makes sense to square, absolute values square this sum. But then if you look at the Dirichlet series, you still have that n to the it, and there's no way to really, it's not smooth enough to deal with, so you sort of want to remove the t dependence, and you do that by averaging or integrating from 0 to t. So he basically looked at the square of both sides integrated from 0 to t. And when you do that, you sort of have a typical argument, which is that you when you're integrating from 0 to t, the weight only matters for zeros that are in that integration range. So you can first restrict the zeros to be between 0 and t with a small error. And once you've restricted the zeros, you can extend the integration range all the way because the other parts of the integration range are no longer going to be near zeros. So basically, you can extend the integration range and restrict the summation range to the original integration range with a really small error. And at this point, you can just square out the thing and integrate. And what you'll get is that this inside kernel, just by a simple calculation, is a simple function, a simple weight function. So in that way, the left side of Montgomery's formula just gives you this expression, this sum over pairs of zeros with a weight to sort of keep the zeros close together. So therefore, we maybe I'll keep this guy handy. So we define this function f of xt to be the sum over pairs of zeros, which we've seen is actually equal to this integral of this absolute value squared of this sum over zeros. So you can see immediately that f of xt is greater than or equal to 0. You can also see, because the zeros are symmetric, that you can replace x by, you can replace gamma with gamma prime, and that just switches x to 1 over x. And you have a formula for it here, which is useful for the explicit formula. So now at this point, it's just a matter of write Montgomery's formula now as left side equals right side. We've worked out the mean square of the left side. So you just need to work out the mean square of the right side. And so the left side gives you this function 2 pi x f of x t. Now when you go to do the right side, there's the Dirichlet series, and for that we use a sort of a Parseval relation due to Montgomery and Vaughan, which just says that when you mean square integrate a Dirichlet series, you get the diagonal terms times t plus an error of O of n. It's a formula that's good it's a formula that's good. Now when you apply it here, you just get the mean square of the a sub n coefficients. And I made a mistake here. There's still a lambda squared of n in there. And then you just use the prime number theorem with error term here and partial summation to work it out. And the other terms are all easy to work out because they're all elementary functions. And this one's bounded by x squared. This one's basically log of t over x times the integration range. And this one's small. And then, so you get these main terms, and okay, what's going on here? And then the point is, by Cauchy-Schwarz, if any one of them is bigger than the others, then you know when you square them out, you can say that the main term will be the biggest one, and it turns out that in most of the range, the Dirichlet series is the main term, the xt log t. But when x is really small, this log factor is the main term. So you basically have two main terms, and there's a small intermediate range where if you're sloppy, you can just say it's bounded by some error term that is contained in the previous two. So basically, you get the right-hand side is made up of two main terms. There's a Dirichlet series piece, and there's a piece near when x is 1 from the log of t term. And therefore, you then get a formula for this f of x t, which is a Dirichlet series piece, t over 2 pi log x, a piece for when x is close to 1, sort of a delta function at the origin. And Montgomery, I think, had a good idea, which was when you're working, you often want to work with this one, but you know, when you're doing certain calculations, it's better to make the x be a function of t. So you let x be t to the alpha, and then you normalize by the size of the main term here. And this is Montgomery's well-known f of alpha function. And the conclusion of this is that you get Montgomery's theorem, which says that if you look at it, you see you plug in here t to the alpha for x, so you're going to get an alpha in front, and then you divide by the t over 2 pi log t. So you get an alpha as a main term, and then the delta function piece, you know, when alpha is 0, it is actually size log of t, but as soon as alpha is any size at all, it just exponentially goes down. And you can do a little bit better on at the very edge when alpha is, this is actually only going to hold up to alpha as 1 minus epsilon, but you can do a little bit better and get 1 as well. So basically, this is Montgomery's theorem, and I think I ran out of time, so I'll stop here. Yeah.
How do they manage to fit the computer here on the Z function?
How do they compute them?
Yeah.
What? Yeah, Rubinstein's going to tell you. Yeah. Yeah. I actually computed the first two myself. So it's easy, in other words. You can use the Dirichlet series, even though it doesn't converge, you can use a partial sum of it. And there's something called Euler-Maclaurin that lets you put in a few correction terms. So I've done two of them, so that means it's even doable by me. It's easy. It's like computing. It's like asking me to compute sine of. I don't know. It's in books how to actually implement it. Like Edwards' book does some calculations. Okay. The f of, okay, I'm in trouble. Yeah, where is that last one? Is it this? This one. Okay, the connection with random matrix theory.
So the point is that the statistic here for the 2-point correlation found with the mean zero, based on boundary improvement for the region between alpha equal 0 and alpha equal 1, agrees with the random weighted statistics for the 2-point correlation found random weighted time values. But this is what a previously called form factor, which is proven the linear behavior of the form factor between 0 and 1.
Right. Right, so between 0 and 1, it's linear, and then we will conjecture tomorrow that it's then becomes constant 1. Yeah. I think Montgomery knew about that. He called these things form factors, and I thought he was just being some fancy pants, you know. It turned out. Yeah.
Do we have a question?
Yeah.
I guess we can move on to the next.